Hello everyone, my name is Josh Gilliland, blogger for the Legal Geeks and Bowtie Law. Today we have a special celebrity guest panel from the eDiscovery world to talk about the 40th anniversary of the paper chase and legal education. Jessica and I have gathered some of our closest friends from eDiscovery to talk about this. First, we have Craig Ball from Texas, who is now not just an eDiscovery guru, forensic expert, but a law professor. Craig, how are you today?
Well, thank you, Josh. I'm looking forward to doing this.
Glad to have you here. Also up is someone I went to college with. That's Caitlin Murphy. She's now in charge of legal marketing at Access Data. We cut our teeth together in the early days of eDiscovery, pre-Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Caitlin, how are you doing?
Hi, Josh. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the panel.
We also have Kelly Twigger from ESI Attorneys. It's a law firm that helps other attorneys with eDiscovery issues. Kelly, how are you?
I'm doing great, Josh. Thanks so much for having me on today.
Pleasure to have you. And with that, I turn it over to Jessica for our first round of questions.
Thanks, Josh, and thanks everyone for being with us today. So we're here to talk about the paper chase. We all obviously have had our different law school experiences. I say hook'em because I went to the University of Texas Law School. you can't see Craig right now, but he's doing the hook'em horns too. So the first question, of course, we have to start with the dominant character. The whole reason the paper chase exists, of course, is, and I think the person that Josh was dressed in honor of today is Professor Kingsfield. And the question is, so Professor Kingsfield in the movie, that was 40 years ago, the year I was born, holy cow. But would a professor like that still exist? Would he still thrive in today's atmosphere? You know, we all hear about how students have to be coddled these days, how you have to be so much more, concerned about their sensibilities. Students can rate their professors. So, Craig, I'm going to ask you first, since you are actually a professor today, do you think, would Professor Kingsfield still be allowed to teach the way he does?
Well, I think someone of Kingsfield's exalted stature would be given wide berth to teach in almost any way, because despite the abuses that he heaped on his students and the cutting remarks that he shared, they would have been so enamored of the opportunity to bask in the glow of the great man, he'd probably get away with it. But a rank-and-file professor would be savaged by the students, would be very low in the ratings, would find enrollments probably dropping to the point where, unless it was an essential course, like contracts, that professor would be hard-pressed to make it in a high-prestige, high-demand faculty like Harvard's.
Caitlin, how about you? What do you think? And did you have any professors like Kingsfield yourself? And where did you go to law school again?
I went to University of California at Hastings Law School, which has a reputation for being quite cutthroat, but definitely didn't have any professors like Kingston and Kingsfield in my experience. I did have a Crosby Law professor who used to, you know, call me out in class for giggling too much with my friends in the back row, but nobody like that. But you know what really struck me when I was watching the other night is I didn't think he was that much of a bully. He skipped people when they weren't prepared. He made fun of Hart when he was being kind of like, you know, a petulant kid. And, you know, rightfully made fun of him. But I thought as filmmakers, they didn't build up that meanness as much as they really could have. That could be, you know, me looking back on law school with, you know, the eyes of somebody who's been out in the profession for a long time and not a frightened student, because I definitely remember thinking differently of him when I first watched the movie when I was a 1L. But that was the main takeaway. But yeah, aside from that, no, a bullying professor would have a much harder time these days. We're much more a touchy-feely world than we used to be. And I think Craig's point is a good one. You know, if the professor's got high standing, people just want to bask in the glow. But other than that, yeah, with the rate my teacher or rate my prof, if I go over and with some interesting reading, go to that site and see what people think of your old law school professor. So yeah, definitely a different world.
Kelly, how about you? What do you think?
You know, I have to kind of agree with Caitlin that I think that the professor, I didn't think he was that bad. And in a lot of ways, he resembles a lot of judges these days. So if you stand up in court and don't know what you're supposed to be talking about, no judge is going to coddle you. For me, I think today, some of the coddling of the generational differences that we have is problematic for lawyers who are coming out of school, you know, when I'm dealing with some younger people. And so I quite liked him, but I was a bit of a sadist and I loved law school, so.
Kelly, I actually have to agree with you. I actually had a professor who reminded me, he was my contract professor, and we spent the first 3 weeks of class on Hawkins v. McGee, and he reminded me a lot of Kingsfield, and it's one of those things, would he have been like that but for the paper chase? But he was definitely a tough professor, but he was the type of professor that I wanted in law school, and this is even over 10 years ago now at UT, where you did have some of the old style professors like him, and then some who were that more coddling approach, which I still don't think is appropriate for law school. And I think it goes to your point, Kelly, that at least if you're going to be a litigator, or even if you're a business attorney dealing with tough business clients, they're not going to coddle you. And so you're not doing any favors if you do coddle them and spoon feed them in law school. Josh, how about you? What do you think?
It's a mix. You know, I thought Kingsfield actually was a good professor. I didn't see anything evil or sadistic about him. When we get into some of the other atmospheric questions about law school, I'll have a piece to say there. In my experience, we did have some sadistic professors that people avoided like the plague, that, you know, somebody who enjoyed making a student cry, that sort of thing, that just seemed very mean-spirited. And when you're dealing with that, you're kind of missing the purpose of revenge. Revenge is not a pay-it-forward doctrine. It's to go after those who wronged you. And if there's a prof who wants revenge on the person who tortured him in law school, going after the future attorneys is not the best way to exact that revenge. So other than like two instances of that in my, you know, law school experience, there was nothing like that. Atmospherically, though, we can talk about that. Which brings us to the next question about pressure. So for law students today, is the pressure worse or greater or simply different in today's law school environment? And Craig, you know, you see it, you're going to see it on Monday. What do you think?
Yeah, I do. I do start my class at law school on Monday. And by way of a little background, to tell you where I'm coming from, my father went to Harvard Law School, was class of 1932, which meant that he would have been a classmate with the hypothetical Charles Kingsfield at the time he wrote the famous contract notes that were the holy grail of so much of this thing. So I have my father's experience to draw on. I graduated from University of Texas Law School, as like Jessica, back in 1982. And so have a sort of the next generation of what it was like. And now, 30 years after I left law school, I started going back and teaching law school. So it was an interesting observation of generations. To the point, Josh, remind me what the question is. Let's put out my generation in perspective here. I've already forgotten the question.
The pressure on law students. You know.
Oh yes, the pressure on law students. Well, it's different. I mean, you know, the academic pressure to succeed, to excel, has always been there. But what makes it that much more brutal today is the changed job market. I think we all recognize that when we got out of law school, whatever our law school, if we performed reasonably well, upper tier of the class, we could be assured of finding a reasonably good job, if not a great job. On the other hand, today, if you emerge from a law school in the bottom two tiers of law schools and you're not at the very top of your class, you might as well think about dental school or business school. You are really looking at a distressed job market with no near-term prospects of improvement, a totally changed, probably forever, legal market.
I agree with that, and it's sad. And like there have been articles in Above the Law and many other, you know, publications about the changed job market and what attorneys today are going through and the fear factor. Caitlin, your thoughts on the pressure on today's law students?
Well, I like Craig, I really think it's probably just a case of it being different. You know, and I think that's largely because of technology, and I don't want to get too far into the technology question because I know we're going to spend some more time on that. But, you know, I was kind of right on the cusp of that change from writing everything longhand to, you know, kids bringing the their laptops to class and, like, taking all their notes on their laptop. I had a laptop my second year, but not my first year. They still made us go and learn how to look things up in the books and library. I imagine that went away a few years afterwards. So, with those things, you know, it seems like the pressure would have gotten a little bit less. You know, you don't have to learn how to do things this kind of longhand way anymore. For example, you don't have to handwrite your outlines anymore. You can probably go online and find a treasure trove of great thorough outlines for free or study aids for free. You don't have to pay for them. But in that way, in that sense, the competition is a little bit stronger though too. So it's not just about, you know, you writing your own great outline. You really have to think about answering questions like a lawyer. And that's the way I think the pressure is probably still the same. You know, it gets down to it. You still have to learn to think like a lawyer and answer exam questions like a lawyer, which, you know, no amount of technology or study aids is really going to help you with that. You just have to learn to be a critical thinker. But the kind of point that I put in my notes is the one that Craig made, is the job market. You know, the business of law has become such a business, and you just don't have the opportunities that you did, say, in 1975 when these guys would have graduated. You know, the percentage of lawyers in the population was much smaller than it is now. So, yeah, in that way, the pressure is much, much worse today.
Kelly, your thoughts on the pressure on law students?
You know, I think that Caitlin had a great point with the technology changes, because I think that technology has really changed not only the legal market, but the way that businesses do business, and therefore the way that they need lawyers, and the way that law firms are doing business. I mean, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag for me on the law firms, because we read so much about how law firms need to change the way that they do business, and how law firms are changing, and I honestly don't see that much of law firms actually changing, but I think that, you know, clients are less on board with lawyers and law firms using them to train their lawyers anymore, and so that makes a big impact. And, you know, one of the big things that all of us are very much involved in, which is technology-assisted review, is changing how review is being done. And at many very large law firms, that's what you spend your first 3 to 4 years, if not longer, doing. And they're not going to be doing that anymore, which changes the economics of the law firms, which changes how many people they hire, which changes how you get trained, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very, trickle down, I guess I would say, effect that I think is not good for law students. But I also think that what Craig said is right on, and that is you don't have an option but to perform well at law school. I went to Marquette Law School in Milwaukee, and when I graduated in 1997, you needed to be in the top 10% of your class to get interviews. You didn't get interviews if you weren't in that top 10%. And I don't know what it's like today, you know, 17 years later, but I think it's tough. I think it's a tough market. And I do think that that the learning how to think as a lawyer is very important and very key, and is useful in so many different professions. But you have to be willing to go at it on your own and to be able to think about your career. And I think that's where sometimes current students are going to break down a little.
I went to McGeorge and was class 2001. And the career development office was very helpful to those who were in the top 5 to top 3% of the graduating class. The rest of us were on our own. And which always blew me away for a career development office to go, we are only going to take care of 3 to 5% of our clients. And the other 95 are on their own. So that was scary. I know it's gotten better. They had a change in leadership, so that was a good thing. But, you know, there's the technology side. There was the Kia Motors outside counsel test that went out from, you know, to all of the trial attorneys for Kia. And they all failed. Yep. You know, and so, Jessica, why don't you take it from here on the technology side?
Well, I was going to say that does lead into, and obviously I always explained, even when I was in law school back before eDiscovery, you know, there's still an obvious difference between what I was doing in law school and how paper-driven it still was, and this was late 90s, early 2000s. We had Westlaw, we had Lexis, but they did still force us to shepherdize. I shepherdized one time in the library, the law library, you know, with those books, and I was like, good God, this is awful. But, you know, compared to my business school friends or even my previous corporate experience, you know, law school and lawyers were clearly behind the times from a technology standpoint. But I think that that problem with law school versus the technology of the real world and what business, you know, clients expect from their lawyers is just increasing every day. So, you know, how has technology altered the world of paper chase? I mean, obviously the Socratic method, you still need to learn how to think like a lawyer. But as far as, you know, looking at 85-year-old contract notes or doing everything by longhand and what they're focused on in law school, you know, does that really apply to the world that lawyers then, you know, assuming they can get a job when they graduate, how much does all of that apply and what do, you know, what are law schools doing or what should they be doing, I guess, to address this technology issue? And Kelly, this time I'll start with you since you always get stuck third. So.
Oh, that's okay. You know, in response to the paper chase and the whole 85-year-old contract notes, other than Hart being completely obsessed with Kingsfield, I really didn't understand at all why those were important. I mean, for me, I would have never, ever, ever visited 85-year-old contract notes. I think he found some solace in the fact that he was just like the professor as a law student was just like him. And, you know, I guess do what you have to do. Maybe that's a Harvard thing. I don't know. I wouldn't have spent my time that way. In terms of the technology, I guess when I'm writing something or I'm speaking to clients who are generally older than me, and I'm 42, they don't speak all in technology, and they don't live on Westlaw. And, you know, so I think that technology has changed the generation that's below me so much so that it's very difficult for them to understand how to communicate with sometimes my generation and generations that are older than me. And so I think that there are efficiencies. Lawyers are so behind the times when it comes to using technology efficiently, and even the way that we practice is very inefficient, that I love how technology is forcing the law to move forward faster. But I think in terms of the paper chases, I thought about it. I was like, well, you'd see that whole classroom filled with laptops. But I don't know that the professor would have been teaching any differently. I think the outlines wouldn't have been written out in longhand. We wouldn't have had that dramatic scene of the 800 pages of the property outlines flying out the window. I don't know. I don't know if it would have helped Hart write that paper for Kingsfield any faster to have had Westlaw as opposed to the books. I still find myself sometimes printing out opinions so that I can sit with them and see the words as opposed to staring at them on a computer screen. So I don't know. I think it's had pluses in terms of us being able to be more efficient and effective in practice, but I think it's had drawbacks in the ability for students and younger lawyers to do the analysis we need them to do to become better lawyers.
Thanks, Kelly. Craig, what do you think? I mean, you kind of have the one foot in the e-discovery world and then one foot in kind of the old school law school. Not that it's old, but what do you think of how law schools are trying to adapt? What do you think with the actual professors?
Well, I think the point about the laptops is an important one in more ways than one. Not only would you never have seen the chins of any of the students in that amphitheater class, but the recognition is those laptops are not only open taking extensive notes. We know, and everyone who teaches in classrooms today know, that you're doing battle with email, with Facebook, with people who think they're going to get the answer if you call on them by something they can find on the internet. And so you're competing with the most compelling opponent, in a sense, or a competitor out there. For me, I think the change has to be at the front of the class. And in my case, if any of you have ever heard me speak, you know that it's not so much me speaking as I'm narrating a very visually intensive, very active barrage of no text images that are coming at the viewer. And I do that in my classroom as well, animations and so forth, because I want my students to feel that if they aren't looking at the front of the room, they're not getting the whole show. And that is as much a ploy on my part to wean them from Facebook as it is anything else. I think also we need to see and are seeing new teaching techniques. I've had to be much more interactive with my students. They have to have projects. I do something called visiting professor. And the joke there is I pick one or two students and I assign them to come stand at the front of the room and do my job and teach us a particular case. I also feel that it's important to have a lot of, in the e-discovery world, have a lot of exercises that they are doing, a lot of computer work using search tools and so forth. And finally, flip learning is something I'm trying to build on. The idea that these lectures that I give would probably be as effective if I recorded them much as we are doing here today and let the students either see them for the first time or review them outside of class and then use the class time to really address what I said in a more relevant context for the students getting their input rather than me using our time together for me to talk alone. Kingsfield wouldn't do that. Kingsfield was a strict Socratic method authoritarian. He was brilliant at it. I don't think that, you know, anyone probably better depicts the Socratic method than the Charles Kingsfield character.
Wow, that is a totally different law school experience that you're describing now, Craig, than what I remember. And at that time, professors mainly just had to compete with the crossword. We all had the crossword in class, but that was the only competition. So, and I did improve my vocab.
Well, the nice thing about that is the crossword in the Daily Texan was the New York Times crossword, so
that's
it was
right.
The best domestic crossword.
That's right. So you do know that crossword.
Very.
I missed the Daily Texan. Caitlin, how about you? What do you think about the technology issues?
Well, I think some of what I'm going to say is echo what everybody else has said. I think also the world of paper chase, yeah, that iconic scene of the papers all falling through the sky and, you know, bells screaming out the window, you know, wouldn't exist anymore. It'd be more like if, you know, you had a hard drive failure and you couldn't recover all of your outlines, something like that. But I think what Craig is saying is really interesting about, you know, the professors having to compete for students' attention. I mentioned earlier that I, my first year of law school, I didn't have a laptop. My second and third years, I did. And for me, it wasn't the internet and the email, but it was solitaire. So I sit and play solitaire, which, you know, isn't quite as taxing on your mental processes as reading an email or, you know, looking at some kind of new content that comes across your screen. But definitely got you through the boring points. But at that time, the professors were kind of still able to just do their kind of, you know, their shit, their rote kind of whatever kind of teaching style they were doing. But now I imagine, yeah, you really have to be pretty dynamic to compete with what the students are looking at these days. The other thing is, yeah, the law library scene. Does anybody go into the law library these days? Like, other than to find a quiet study carol during exam time? I mean, I can't imagine that those books are even leaving the shelves. Are they even publishing them, printing them anymore?
The only reason those books still exist, because the ABA accreditation is still years out of date, requires massive traditional libraries to get high accreditation. And so we spend millions of dollars on libraries that hardly anyone uses except for obscure research.
It's probably the book publishing lobby. They're in bed with the ABA people making the regulations. The other thing that occurs to me is the Harrison Ford, you know, graduating, I would imagine, 1975, the movie was maybe 72, roughly 25 years old. They would be about 63 today. So there is a senior partner making the purchasing decisions for law technology at the firm now. I was looking up for kind of a benchmark. David Bowie, for example, is 72, and he's probably one of the more well-known senior partners in the world. So, you know, the fact that they started out kind of, you know, crawling through air ducts to find 1932 books of contract notes and now have something like predictive coding kind of being presented to them must be quite a journey, you know, for them. And luckily, people who graduated from Harvard Law School and learned to think critically like lawyers can hopefully kind of, you know, incorporate both of those worlds into their practice and move on with the times, although I know that that's not the overarching trend. But yeah, technology, it's altered everything completely, especially the world of paper chase, especially the legal world, given all of us a job, right?
Yeah, well said, Caitlin. They started in 72 or 73. 72 is when Pong came out. It was the last mission to the moon. And like the scope of their lives has seen some, you know, profound changes from the first digital watches also in 1972 on the march forward to smartphones. And so, I mean, just this, it's a huge leap.
Well, consider the most, perhaps the most famous line in the movie. We could probably all recite it together. Here is a dime, Mr. Hart. Go to a payphone. First of all, I don't know where he's going to find a payphone today. Second of all, I don't know what he's going to be able to call for a dime.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to get a dial tone for the dime.
And we were in Europe last week, and we actually saw payphones. I took a picture because I was amazed and astounded.
Did your child ask mommy what's that?
No, I was lucky enough to be there without children.
Okay.
Oh, lucky you.
I know, it was great.
Great Britain? Was it a red phone box?
No. It was a big red. It said Verizon on it, which I thought was very strange because everybody that I was with had Verizon smartphones and none of them worked in Europe. So I thought the irony was palpable.
So as we talk about the 85-year-old contract notes, let's talk about legal education and how it's changed. And I'll throw out it took 30 years after Llewellyn proposed going to the Socratic method in the 19th century for Harvard and the other law schools to adopt it. They fought it tooth and nail, just as attorneys have fought technology tooth and nail. A friend of mine, trial attorney for one of the big insurance companies, she won a case. The managing partner reprimanded her because she put the jury instructions for the closing argument in a PowerPoint slide. And he thought very little of her for doing that. Utterly insane, the resistance to technology. And that's one that helped the jury remember what they were talking about. But as we talk about education, and I mean, I've seen Craig present, and I would love to see him teach his class. But, you know, how's the educational model changed? And Craig, why don't you go first, since you got a lesson plan.
Well, I wanted to add, in the other side, when I spoke about technology, I spoke about its challenges and how you have to compete with it, but I didn't speak about the positives, and they are manifold. We use a teaching platform currently. It's changing, but right now it's called Blackboard, and if any of you have taught using Blackboard or something like it, the ability to have forums for the exchange. My students, for example, are required to do a minimum number of posts of merit in our discussion forum as part of their credits, the ability to communicate, the ability to bring new cases to them. I'm able to teach the class with extensive materials that are entirely free because I have a distribution method that doesn't require me reducing it to paper. It allows me to update it and change it. So the ability to have an online teaching platform for communication, for collaboration, interaction, and testing. I do a midterm as well as a final, and my midterm's multiple choice, so the students get it graded automatically and immediately for that feedback and then can review the questions that they got wrong. So for all some ways curse the challenge of technology from an attention standpoint, it makes my job as a teacher so much easier, and I think the quality of education, if not the quality of focus and critical thinking, the quality is in many ways enhanced today than it was when I went to school or when Hart went to school, or for that matter, when Charles Kingsfield, my dad, went to law school.
Well said. I hate saying this, back in my day, 1998, we used Tween, which was the platform to communicate between the students. And it was very early project collaboration type of SAS that put out course assignments, that sort of thing. I've guest lectured at my alumni, and the stuff they have now is superior. And it's gone a long ways, and there's a lot of good stuff there. But Caitlin, what are your thoughts about how technology has impacted how legal education takes place?
Well, I did want to talk about the kind of basics before I went into technology, because I do think they're still sound. You know, the Socratic method, as much as we all hated it when we were in law school, it's still a good one for lawyers. You know, you need to learn how to think on your feet when you're on the spot. You need to prep ahead of time for an anything can happen atmosphere. Whether it's a judge or a senior partner grilling you about why you did something or why you said something, or if you have to get up on a cross examination and think of something new to say, or react to some of the bombshell in the courtroom. So I do think that in that way, the Socratic method is unparalleled in getting people prepared to think that way. That said, those things that I'm describing, most of them are kind of the prominent problems of trial lawyers. So a lot of lawyers don't have to do the kind of courtroom gotcha stuff, but they are often defending their decisions either to clients or to senior associates or partners. Similarly, the exam system, the closed book exam at the end of the year, prepped you for the bar, still for better or for worse. Take-home exams, which was actually the majority of what I did in law school, you check out your exam for 24 hours and you have, an open book, 24 hours to write it. That preps you to write briefs and motions to deadlines and to, be able to do those things quickly, make an argument, revise it quickly, and get it in on time. So those things are still sound. Obviously, the thing missing in the model is technology, as we've all been talking about, the kind of social media aspect of learning, the community aspect of learning that's such a big part of it these days. Having, as Craig was describing, as you were describing, Josh, a common platform to go and exchange ideas about what was in the lecture makes the learning experience so much richer. So while those basics are there and they're still strong, I think, the educational model has changed for the better due to technology.
Kelly, your thoughts?
I agree completely with what Craig and Caitlin have said, and I would say that particularly when it comes to, if I could have had some of my professors' lectures recorded and been able to revisit them, not eliminate the need to go to class, but to be able to revisit them or to be able to see them if for some reason you had to miss class, I think that would have been invaluable when I was in law school and we never had that opportunity. I also think that particularly with, I guest lectured a number of e-discovery classes, and the ability to teach an e-discovery class effectively without technology, I think would be impossible. I don't know how you would do it. And Craig, I know you're number one aficionado, and you use technology in so many amazing ways in your classes. But in the classes that I lecture in, we use review platforms, and we literally have the students have a login where they conduct searches and they learn how to use the review platforms, and that's all done via technology. And then we look at the results and we look at who had challenges and why they had challenges and what the differences were in the searches and why things are different in terms of teaching them how to conduct this online review, because we don't do paper review anymore. And if you're out there and you're listening and you do paper review, please call one of us. And so I think that, for exactly what Caitlin said, which is the ability to teach lawyers how to think analytically, the way law school education is set up is very valid. Before I forget, I must say that I wish I went to law school either with Craig, where we got multiple choice exams, or with Caitlin, where she got to take home her exams, because I had neither of those experiences. But I think that there's a lot of real benefits in addition to the fact that you can get information so quickly. I can search Westlaw at 10 o'clock at night on my iPad and find what it is that I need to find. The number of times that I wouldn't have had to been in my office until 3 a.m. Just based on technology would have been fantastic.
By the way, Kelly, just to be, you don't want to be in my class. The midterm is multiple choice, but the final is the proctored two-hour essay exam that you would expect.
Excellent.
Oh, by the way, yesterday I guest lectured at the e-discovery class for Judge Xavier Rodriguez. He teaches it at St. Mary's Law School. He uses an online hosted platform of review called Lexby, and I use one called Relativity. And I'm, you know, obviously you all know these, but there are any number of these. I think it's crucial that we have hands-on search as a component of what we teach.
And I agree.
And since we just shouted out a couple companies, Caitlin set up my high school mock trial students with Summation. And so I was able to go over the fact pattern with the students through that and teach them going over the hearsay issues and everything else. So it is a phenomenal process. Now,
Caitlin, I'd be happy to try, if there's an online version of Summation, I'd be happy to stick it on my students.
Cool. I'll email you afterwards, Craig.
So let's talk about the study methods in the paper chase. And I will then highlight what happened with me at McGeorge. So in the movie, the study group of six gets together. By the end, there's only three. And they all take this point of view that each one's assigned an outline, and which was something highly recommended against. And they opted not to do practice exams, which just seemed to be the most deadly decision you can make, because they weren't practicing how to apply what in my day at McGeorge was called IRAC, Issue, Rule, Analysis, Conclusion. Now they frequently with bar exams, they do what's CRAC, Conclusion, Rule, Analysis, Conclusion. They weren't practicing that. There was absolutely no discussion of that in the film. In my McGeorge experience, we had a good study group, but my dyslexia works in a way that I prefer to sit down and read and then talk about it. The other four in our group preferred to just talk about it and not read the cases. And I did, you know, B's and C pluses in the classes I worked with them on. In civil procedure, where I did it on my own, I had the second highest grade in the class. And that was also because of the way the professor taught. He broke down the statutes and the Asahi decision and Pennoyer v. Neff on PowerPoint and did a very nice visual display to highlight what normally would be complicated subjects that the Supreme Court still wrestles with today. And so why don't we start with Kelly, but you know, why don't you, what's your view on the study methods that the film depicted and what you experienced in your time in Milwaukee?
Oh, well, as far as the, you know, the study group I found to be very entertaining. I put together a study group when I first went to Marquette. And truthfully, I put together the study group because when I got there, I realized that I needed to know a lot more history than I knew, and I didn't know nearly enough. So what I did was gather the smartest people in my class and put them all into a study group, and we met once or twice a week to really talk through things. And truthfully, I used all of their knowledge. You know, I said, I need to understand what the background of this case was, what was happening here, you know, in terms of understanding what's going on in this constitutional law situation. And so that's how we used our study group. I couldn't fathom leaving my law school education up to five other people in terms of drafting their outlines. And even then, I'm not sure I would have believed them, but maybe I'm just a control freak. That has never come up before, I'm sure. So, So I think that in terms of studying, I don't know how technology improves that. I guess for me, sometimes you can get too lost in the technology of trying to add everything into Flipboard or make sure that you're using this one app exactly the way you need to, and you get lost in using the technology instead of spending the time with the analysis and really thinking through what needs to be happening. So I think that technology enhances that. I mean, certainly, I was really one of those losers who took law school notes copiously and then went back and redid outlines, you know, recopied my notes and everything else. So if I had a laptop, like Caitlin said, she did her last 2 years and could just reorganize and reiterate. But I learned so much from my process that I think it's so dependent on the person. I would guess that students these days are so used to technology, that's how they used to learn. So I'm not sure if my methods are probably as good as theirs when it comes to using technology effectively.
Caitlin, what war stories do you have?
Well, I would when I saw this question, I immediately thought of the scene where Ford and Hart, you know, decamp from the dorms at Harvard to a hotel room, and it kind of shows them, like, hunkered down with, you know, food everywhere, like old room service plates and balled up pieces of paper, and, you know, there's obviously in a very bunker-like mentality. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, that wasn't very different from the way I used to get exam time. You know, I'd wear the same hat every day and listen to the same piece of classical music over and over again while I studied. You get a little bit crazy while you study it, especially when you do a take-home exam and you're sitting in the library for 24 hours straight trying to do this exam. So in that way, this, you know, the study method is a little bit pretty similar. You know, everybody has their idiosyncrasies and everybody gets a little mad around exam time. But I imagine now that it's probably a lot more material available online, maybe less need for study groups and created outlines. Like Kelly said, I really gained a lot from creating my own outlines. And in fact, for the bar, I actually wrote out my own outlines, spoke them into a micro cassette recorder, which I wouldn't need anymore, I could just do it with my computer, and then listen to them over and over again to try to get my memory pathways open in like three different ways. And, you know, I couldn't imagine having memorized that much material without doing something like that. But, you know, even that said, you know, you can be more of a lone wolf, you can be a little bit more lazy when it comes to creating your own material, but I think, you know, at some point, you gotta do it yourself so that it gets into your head. Because once you walk in, you know, especially to the bar or a closed book exam, that's all you've got. So, yeah, in some ways things have changed, in some ways they've stayed the same.
Craig, your thoughts?
Well, going back to my experience, I never was a member of a study group. I'm going to be one of those people you hate, and I don't say this as though I was the top of the class or anything, or number one, but I found law school to be more common sense. I had taken business law as an undergraduate at Rice from a fellow who was more like the Kingsfield character than anyone I've ever encountered, a wonderful fellow named C.M. Hudspeth, who had us do the diagramming of cases, the abstracting of cases, just as you've described, Josh. And having done that for a year at Rice, I felt very comfortable reading cases and so forth at UT. But what I have noticed in my own classes is that the competition or the sense of wariness of the other students has not gone away. As an example, on certain projects, I give my students the chance to pair up to do the project. Now, I look at it and I say, wow, you know, I'd look for the person in the class I thought was much better at this than I am. I'd love to pair up with that person. At worst, the workload would be cut in half, and we'd both get the same grade for it. To me, that is a natural. Almost no one in my classes has elected to pair up with another student in the projects. They all choose to do it by themselves. My wife says it's because of the coordination of their very busy schedules and so forth, but I think it's more than that. I think it's just the sense that they know they're going to be competing with that person and they don't necessarily want to give anybody else a leg up.
You know, McGeorge was very competitive, but, you know, the study groups at Forint were actually pretty tight-knit with the all-for-one, one-for-all mentality. We didn't see any, like, you know, pages ripped out of books, that sort of thing, but that's interesting to hear what you've observed. So this is a fun question, and I have to credit it to Craig, and I don't know if it's because I have to apologize for having dated his daughter, but we'll start with the age-old question. Have you ever slept with one of your professor's grown children? And if you did it impact your grade?
No. Comment. No, I'm just kidding. No, I did have a relationship with my legal writing and research professor, though. It was a long relationship. I did get an A, but we broke up afterwards.
Scandal. We did have at McGeorge somebody who was dating a prof, and, you know, that, you know, one of the legal writing professors, so like that was a little scandalous at the time, but
it was after the class was over, though.
Yeah, she was like the TA for the prof, but still a student. So it was, yeah, I would not, I think that'd be a bad life choice, but that's just, I would not ever do
that. It did turn out to be a bad life choice for me, but it was very educational.
Craig, since you asked the question, are you going to take the fifth on this?
No, I won't take the fifth. I will say that in one occasion, I got close, but never actually sealed the deal. And it didn't, it not only did it not affect my grade, but I ended up working for this person who was my mentor for many years, and it was a wonderful experience. But I never sealed the deal later either.
Good to know. Well, in the film, it depicts Harvard Law students not being the type of folks you want to associate with. Some of them are quite abrasive and quite jerks. Has anyone ever experienced that, whether from any law school? Do you still think it exists?
Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
I don't, again, I've met Harvard attorneys, and the Harvard Law Library has been a great fan of the Legal Geeks. They retweet our stuff. I reached out to them about, you know, I had a trip planned to Boston, and they welcomed me to go in and do a podcast from there. So I've been by there. It's a lovely campus. I don't know what it was like in 1973, but I'd like to visit.
You know, may I add something on that? Jay Osborne, who was Harvard Law class of 70, and he wrote the novel, The Paper Chase, that became the movie, and then wrote many of the scripts for the television series that followed. He wrote an article about literally 10 years ago where he did a retrospective on Harvard, and the occasion was that his daughter was just matriculating into Harvard Law School as a first-year law student, so kind of a nice circle. And he indicated that Harvard had really changed, that the Kingsfield who meets Hart on the elevator, remember how Hart is so dedicated, and he meets Kingsfield, and the two of them are standing side by side on this elevator, and Hart is just trying his hardest without falling to his knees and performing sexual favors on Kingsfield. He's trying his hardest. Look at the face you make on that one, Josh. He's trying his hardest to impress Kingsfield with how much Kingsfield mattered to him. And Kingsfield just leaves him with this, "You're just another person on my seating chart. What was your name, Mr. Who Failed Me When I Gave You a Chance?" And really, that uses that last contact to just cut out Hart's guts. Well, Osborne says, no, it's not like that. That Harvard is a kinder, gentler place today, that the Kingsfields that he went with, the fear factor that dominated his years at Harvard Law School, are a thing of the past. So I don't know if Harvard men and women are still jerks. I know that they still all wear their Veritas rings, and somehow the fact that they went to Harvard manages to creep into a conversation. I don't know how that works.
Regularly.
Exactly, Kelly. Yeah. It's hard to be with someone who went to Harvard and not know it in the first 10 minutes you're together.
For every 10 minutes after that, yes.
But let's face it, most of us say that with a tinge of envy in our voice. And so many, many great people have come out of Harvard Law School. My father, certainly great in my life. And so I'm grateful that there is a Harvard Law School and hope that there always will be.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind guest lecturing on eDiscovery there. I'd put that on the resume pretty fast. So, but let's talk about the future, since we've talked about what this 40-year-old movie has meant to us who all went to law school after it. And, I mean, Craig, you're on the front lines, but what do you think law schools need to teach today's students to be effective and competent lawyers?
Well, I thank you for that, but I think we're all on the front lines of educating when it comes to the need to integrate technology and law. All of us, with our focus on electronic discovery, certainly. There is no question in my mind that the days of law school being a purely academic exercise are properly numbered. And when the President of the United States stops and says, you got to get rid of a year of this law school situation, folks. It's just wasting people's time and money. They're emerging with, you know, choking, smothering debt. We need to take that third year and turn it into a skills and clinical program. We need to meet unmet needs with regard to legal services by turning that talent from an academic exercise of the first and second year to a skills and practical exercise in really helping people. Even if we want to turn out great negotiators, great contract writers, great will writers and what have you, deal makers, everyone who's going to do those other things needs to understand the role of representing a human being, representing an entity, standing up, expressing your thoughts, not just as in the Socratic method, but in a court of law, in an adversarial process. No matter what you do in the law, you will do your job better if you've had some experience as something like a trial advocate. So that's what we need to teach. And in conjunction with that, I'm not going to bore all of you with how strongly I feel that the standard of practice today with respect to technology and the law can only be described as gross incompetence. By and large, our peers do not understand information that forms the basis of their practice that is most key to their clients' needs, and so are not competent to deal with the most prevalent forms of evidence today. They could fix it. It's not that hard to learn technology, but it's not going to happen in a one-hour CLE or with a checklist or just throwing a few minutes or saying, I'm going to hire an expert in every case. We have a Manhattan Project that we need in the practice of law, not just to bring along law students, but to salvage the careers and the capabilities of the very bright and skilled lawyers with 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 years of experience that are increasingly marginalized and irrelevant and incompetent because they haven't embraced the appropriate aspects of technology. It's not Xbox and iPod. The young people coming out today are not more technologically astute for e-discovery just because they use a lot of stuff. E-discovery is its own skill. Learnable, but not by osmosis. Sorry for my soapbox.
What I agree with, so well said.
Thank you.
I teach some law firms on e-discovery, and it pains me to hear, oh, you talk about native files, but we just like to have everything as a TIFF here because we want a Bates number on it.
Or PDF.
Just want to scream because they are, exponentially driving up their clients' costs by doing this. And it's absolutely maddening to see people and attorneys, take this point of view that if we just yell at e-discovery, we can make it go away. Well, you can't threaten a technological issue with force of law. It doesn't work that way. It's technology. It's going to stay there until you use technology to solve it. So,
what's scary about it, though, Josh, is that, look, like you mentioned before, that it took law schools 30 years to adopt the Socratic method. I see law schools where professors are trying very hard to teach regular e-discovery courses, bring in people who are practicing in the field, make it really worth the students' time. And the deans just, they aren't on board. They don't believe that technology is key. They believe in traditional, old school, Kingsfield, if you will, sort of practices. And it's a real challenge. I completely agree with what Craig said. And I agree with, frankly, what the president has said, because, at Marquette, one of the beauties of Marquette was that we got a very practical education. By the time I graduated, I had spent 9 months being a prosecutor under the student rules in Wisconsin. I had clerked for a federal judge and written decisions, and I had worked in-house in a legal department where I got to write memos that mattered. And I had lawyers say to me, this is too long. I don't want to hear all of this stuff. You've got to boil this down for me. I want to know what the point is at the beginning of the memo. Law students come out of law school these days with no practical experience because law firm jobs in the summer are few and far between. I was fortunate enough to work with some law students recently on a project for our app, where, you know, they were doing whatever they could do. You know, they went to D.C. and worked for agencies for nothing. They clerked for administrative law judges. And I think that's fantastic. And that's what law students have to be doing. You have to seek out that practical experience, because you don't learn how to apply what you know in law school until you get out of law school and have that experience. And you're of no value to a prospective lawyer if you haven't done it. And that was no different than when I was in law school. I mean, we fought like hell to get law firm jobs or whatever jobs after your second year of law school. And so I think that's all got to happen. But what Craig's saying is absolutely right, that I'm seeing not only lawyers who are of our generation and older who don't understand technology enough to engage in e-discovery, but I see brand new lawyers. I see lawyers at large law firms that I work with who are, you know, not 5-6 years out of law school, that don't understand why asking a custodian what do you use to communicate electronically? They think that's a sufficient question. And it's, you know, they don't understand that. So I think that the e-discovery as a substantive area, the Manhattan Project that Craig talks about, I think that's vital. We could do a whole separate podcast on that.
I think it's more like Project Apollo, but that's just my...
Probably, yeah.
We're not trying to drop a bomb on anyone with this one. We're trying to get to the moon.
Right.
Caitlin, you and I used to have long discussions about this when we worked together. What do you think about today?
Well, I think that it goes even further than, you know, law schools not being invested in teaching their students practical skills. I think law schools actually rate themselves on how little practical skill they teach. So, you know, your Harvards and your Stanfords, your top tier schools are the ivory tower schools. Not only do they not offer these courses, they don't want to offer practical courses because they think that somehow places them lower in the schema of, you know, law school, I don't know what ratings or not ratings, but, you know, standings kind of, you know, and that attitude is just so backward. It drives me crazy. As you and I have discussed many times, Josh, and I talked to a UCLA law student who was interested in e-discovery and had, you know, made it his business to learn about e-discovery because he thought it was going to be important. I actually met him at a large company in Silicon Valley, and he wanted to work there. So he knew that he needed to know, you know, about e-discovery and technology. And he told me that UCLA doesn't offer any courses in e-discovery. And I thought, you know, that's surprising, but of course they don't. You know, it's the smaller schools, the schools that are as highly ranked, quote unquote, who are really leading the charge on this. And it's, unfortunately, the attitude at the higher level school seems to be that they want to distinguish themselves from the schools that lower themselves to teach practical subjects, which is just ridiculous, because sometimes people don't have the opportunity to be a clerk, or, you know, they don't get the summer internship at a firm, and then they come out of law school with no practical skills. And, you know, you get ground up by a large firm, or you get, I work for a small firm, and I was writing motions and, you know, learning kind of in the trenches how to do the work. But I agree with what Craig said in the beginning, which is that, you know, let's get rid of the third year of law school and make that an apprenticeship system like they have in the UK and England, where you actually spend a year of your school apprentice to a lawyer, actually learning how to be a lawyer. Surprise, surprise. And if we can combine that with, you know, low cost or free legal services for people who need them, then what a wonderful thing. But yeah, that law schools are really failing at preparing. They've been failing for a long time at teaching attorneys how to practice law. They've been doing a good job at teaching us how to think critically and how to analyze. That's good. That's only one half of it, though.
I agree with that. I have mixed feelings on eliminating the third year. I'm more for the apprenticeship role. But like my alumni, they do a wonderful job with an e-discovery course. And that professor works really hard and it's done in conjunction with trial advocacy, and he does a good job with it. But teaching depo review and doc review, that's all important. Well, with that, I want to thank you all. We need to you know, call this quits, ring the bell, let applaud as Kingsfield leaves the room. But I want to thank you all for your time and your insights on this. And so, Craig, Caitlin, and Kelly, thank you all very much, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Josh, and thank you, Jessica.
Yep. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
You too.